God, life, I offer myself to you to build with me and do with me as you willed. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties so that victory over them might bear witness to those I would serve of your love, your power, and your way of life. May I do your will always. My name is Donna Lancaster, and I'm a member of Al-Anon. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to be here this weekend. It has just been wonderful. It had been many years since I'd been in West Virginia, and I had forgotten how lovely it really is. It's a beautiful state, and I'm so thankful to be here with you. You see, every time I walk into a room that's filled with you, I'm healed. Because in every smile and in everybody's eyes, I see God. And because of that, I'm whole and well again. Susan and I decided that we're called the Hallmark Team. Because you cared enough to send the very best. Many years ago, I was a student at the University of Kansas, and one of my friends worked in registration, and she came up to me in a few weeks, and she said, Donna, do you know what you put on your application to the university? And I said, no. She said, well, you put your name, which at that time was Donna Hollingsworth, and it had address, and it had guardian, and I put my father, which was V.B. Hollingsworth, and underneath that, it said relationship, and I put satisfactory. Because this program has worked in my life, and because you taught me that alcoholism is a fatal illness, that relationship with my father became satisfactory. My daddy didn't start drinking until later on in life, but you see, life was so painful for him that he couldn't handle it without alcohol. And I would go and visit him, and he wouldn't remember that I was there. And my daddy would never have done anything that would have been harmful to me if he'd had a choice. And yet he could not stand the pain of living. I would call him and I'd say, Daddy, I love you, but I don't like what alcohol does to you. And I was able to tell him that I loved him. And a few years ago in 1980, the pain became so real that he drove the car into the garage and took his own life. And you see, I was okay with that because you had taught me that my daddy did the very best he knew how with what light he had to see by. My daddy had a fatal illness called alcoholism. Neil, my husband, also was an alcoholic, and he did not set a goal when he was in high school that what he wanted to do when he grew up was to be an alcoholic. That was not his goal, to lose his friends, his jobs, his family, his self-respect, and to end up in prison for a crime that he had no recollection of committing. He was in a blackout when he committed the crime. That was not the goal for his life. Yet somewhere along the way, he lost the power to choose. Several years ago, we were in a conference in New York. Neil and I were both delegates at the same time to New York, and we heard a speaker called Dr. Stanley Gitlow, and he explained the illness of alcoholism this way. He said the tiniest one-celled animal has basic instincts and basic drives for food, for warmth, and for reproduction. Man is a multi-celled animal and has the same basic drives, yet the compulsion of alcoholism, the obsession to drink, is so powerful that it will deprive man of every basic drive he has. This will not respond to logic or to reason or to if you loved me, you'd quit drinking. A powerful, compulsive, fatal, destructive illness. I am not an alcoholic. Thank God. By the grace of God, I'm not an alcoholic. But you see, I do things that I don't like myself for. And I have guilt. And I know that if I were hurting the people around me, and if I were destroying the things that I touched, and I could not stop doing those things, I'm sure that the guilt and the self-condemnation would be so powerful and so painful that it would condemn me to drink again. Thank God I'm not the alcoholic. I might have died an alcoholic suicide because I don't stand pain very well. Neil and I started going to meetings in 1958. It's a long time ago. And I would go to these AA meetings with Neil, and I just thought they were wonderful for these people who needed them. And wasn't it grand that there was a place for these poor people to go? Well, and I would listen to what the speakers were saying through Neil's ears. And I would nudge him, of course, and then when we'd get home, we would go over the points I thought that he needed to know. A few months ago, I took a newcomer to an Al-Anon meeting, and you know what? I found myself doing the very same thing. I was hoping that the chairman would say just the right thing and they'd have the right kind of program, and I hope they didn't bring up this because this newcomer, I did. I have no idea what is right for another person. And you see, I've been vice president in charge of the universe. And I had to make the seasons change, and I had to make the sun come up, and I had to make the sunset. You know, it no wonder I was tired all the time. But we went to meetings, and I loved the meetings, and about a year later, we decided that there were some sick ones in our group, some wives of some alcoholics, and they needed to be saved. So we started our little Al-Anon group, and we had two rooms in the back of a shoe store. One was the AA room, and one was the Al-Anon room. And it was a cold November night, and there was one stove. And of course, you know what room got the stove. And we were in Arkansas then, and we had invited the Al-Anon group in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to come over and tell us about Al-Anon, get us started. And here came these three lovely ladies, and they looked so pretty, and they were all dressed up, and here was this dirty old place where we were meeting, but they told us about Al-Anon, and this is what they said, I remember it, that regardless of what's going on in your life, people, places, and things, that this program will allow us to be happy, joyous, and free. That was the message. And you see, that's the message today. They were right. So we started our little old group, and we didn't have much literature back then. We had we had Living with an Alcoholic, the big book of Al-Anon, and we had Lois's Story, one little pamphlet, maybe another pamphlet, and we could zip through those pretty quick. It didn't take us long to get through those, and most of our meetings were just complaining and blaming because we really didn't know what Al-Anon was about, and so we used other literature. We didn't know then we were not supposed to, but, you know, we ran out of stuff to use and stuff to keep us on track. But somehow we struggled along, and you know how sick we all were because they let me be chairman the first 5 years. So I would call around to all the other members because they were really sick, and find out what their problem was, and then I'd center the Friday night meeting around their problem. And of course, we didn't get very far, but we hung on, and in 1964, Neil and I went to Little Rock to the state AA convention, and I heard a speaker there by the name of Gert Bahana, and I don't know what Gert said that night, but I knew this program was for me. It was my program. These were my 12 steps. And I went back to the Friday night meeting, and I had a different outlook. I knew three things. I knew that I was living with a person who is an alcoholic, a fatal illness. Two, I knew that I could not control this illness. I could not cure it. And nor could I provide Neil with the spiritual fitness he needed to maintain his sobriety. You see, I had kept him. We'd drive somewhere, and he'd be driving, and I would read him spiritual books. He was captive in the car. Because I knew that his sobriety was contingent on his spiritual fitness. But I knew now, I could see that I was not responsible for his spiritual fitness. The third thing that I learned that in Little Rock was that this program is for Donna Lancaster. This program would allow Donna Lancaster to actualize her potential, whatever that might be. This program would allow Donna Lancaster to become her own best friend. You see, all my life, I have treated my friends better than I have treated myself. I have been so tough on me. And I would find I would be much kinder to you than I was to myself. But I found out that I am living with me 24 hours a day, and it's to my advantage to be my own best friend. So I'm learning to do that. So we started on the 12 steps, and we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And I could see that I was powerless over Neil as an alcoholic. I hadn't quite caught on that I was powerless over him as a person. There's a difference. And somewhere in our One Day at a Time, it says, we take on the roles of parents of delinquent children. And I have done that. Well, aren't you going to drink all your milk? Yeah. Surely he was an adult, and he knew what to wear and what to say and where to go and how to act, and you know, I was not responsible for his behavior. Pretty big one. Then I found out that I was powerless over the people around me and what they did and what they said and how they acted and circumstances. Then I found out, and this didn't all happen in one Friday night meeting, friends. This took years. Found out that I was powerless over this personality called Donna Lancaster that has driven me. This ego system that seems to surround me and cause me to be mechanical. The ego system. A few years ago, I took the big book, and everywhere it had alcohol, I put ego. And it really spoke to me. Cunning, powerful, and baffling, the ego system. And I'm not saying that I'm completely well, because my hands are sweaty and my mouth is dry, so I still have some ego. I want you to like me, but my well-being today is not contingent on whether you like me or not. So I am powerless. Of myself, I can do nothing. I am powerless. And if I think that I do have power, my life becomes unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I had believed that there was a creator. But it says, talk about self-will run riot. And you better believe I was going to do it, and I was going to do it my way. And thank you. I'll do it myself. Insanity. I've been studying sanity and kind of looking at it and trying to see what sanity means to me. And I think it means wholeness. I think it means that I am clear enough in this brain that is my worst enemy, this mind that is cluttered and in conflict, that if that mind can be clear and bright and light, that at that point I can work in some degree of harmony with the power greater than myself. I think that's sanity, to become clear and free of conflict, to be in harmony with the power of the universe. I'm not there yet, but it looks like that might be a worthy aim for me to look at. Made a decision to turn our life and will over to the care of God as we understood him. And my concept of God has changed, thank goodness. And I don't know when it happened. My first decision started a process. And I'm still in the process of turning my life and will over. But it started something moving inside of me. And I have a different concept of God today than I did in 1958. Thank goodness. And I'll tell you a little bit about that a little bit later. But I make I do these three steps before I get out of bed in the morning. I am powerless and of myself I can do nothing. I come to believe and I make a decision. And this gets me going. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, and I thought this was put in the Al-Anon program for filler. I mean, they really didn't mean for us to write an inventory. I mean, I hadn't been in jail, and I hadn't done all those things, so why would I need to write an inventory? But you know, it's like the story of the turtle that was in the rut, and he couldn't get out of the rut. And a rabbit came along and said, "Well, Mr. Turtle, what are you doing in the rut?" And the turtle said, "I can't get out of this rut." So the turtle said, "Okay, I'll be right back. I'll get some help." So in a little bit, the rabbit came back, and the turtle was gone. And so he looked around, and he found the turtle over beside a tree, and he said, "Well, Mr. Turtle, how did you get out of the rut?" And the turtle said, "I heard a wagon coming." So I heard a wagon coming, and I wrote my first inventory, and don't be discouraged if you haven't written one and have been in the program for a while, because I was in the program 9 years before I wrote my first inventory. And I wrote it on wide-spaced paper and wrote great big so I'd have a lot of pages. You know, that's ego. And I ran so I could run to the Friday night meeting and tell the gang that I had written my inventory. And it didn't amount to much, but it was a beginning. And later on, I wrote another inventory, and I could see that it had value for me. And I learned a lot about depression. Now, I'm sure that living in a beautiful state like West Virginia, no one here has ever had depression. But let me tell you what I found out. I found out that I became depressed when someone was not doing what I wanted them to do, or something wasn't going my way. I found out that I became depressed when there was something in front of me that I didn't want to do. That's called fear or dread. I found out that I became depressed when I had done something I didn't like myself for. And that's called guilt. I found out that I became depressed when I started thinking again that all answers depended on me. And I have spent tons of time and energy trying to figure it out. Figure it out, him out, them out, us out, me out, her out. And there's no answer because the future is an unwritten page. And our minds are not fortune tellers. So I'm wasting my energy trying to figure it out. So I can drop that. I don't have to get into that. I found out that I became depressed if I started living one, stopped living one day at a time. I also found I became depressed when I allowed myself to become emotionally or physically tired. I mean, when you're vice president in charge of the universe, I mean, it's tiresome. And I would get tired. And when I became tired, I didn't want the phone to ring. I didn't want anyone to come to the door. I didn't want to talk to anybody. It was black. I've been giving myself permission to rest and to not do anything. This ego system that has driven me had me doing a lot of things and keeping me busy. Because the ego has only one purpose, and that's to destroy the living being. And if it could keep me going, it would destroy me. And so I've been giving myself permission to rest when I'm tired. Wonderful. And to not do anything. I would be watching television, but I would be knitting while I was watching television. And during commercials, I'd read a book because I didn't want to waste any time. I also found out I became depressed when I felt like I didn't have any choices. Now, I always have choices, but I would get hypnotized into thinking I didn't have any choices. And I would be angry. And that's the other side of the coin of depression. So, when I put all these things in my mental computer, it comes out emotionally immature. Maybe someday I'll grow up. Because you see, this program allows Donna Lancaster to grow up spiritually and emotionally. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And I have a sponsor who helps me to see me. To see me clearly. Because see, I'm blind. I can see you very clearly. Oh, they're just feeling sorry for themselves, or they're angry, or they're this or that. It's very easy to do that. The other day at work, one of the other dispatchers was leaving as I came on duty, and he turned around to me and he said, "Donna, you've been a little bit touchy lately." Well, now, a few years ago, I would have become angry. But thank goodness this program has taught me to say thank you for telling me that. Thank you for caring enough to risk telling me that so that I could look at it. And sure enough, I was a little touchy. That's real friendship. I have a sponsor who helps me to see me more clearly and to bring into my awareness the things that are there to destroy me. I'm not a very good sponsor. I have a few that I work with. But I tell them, I said, I only have two things. Here's my phone number, and you can call me any time of day or night. And number two, I will never agree with you that you are a victim. That's the most destructive thing that I can do to anybody, is to agree with them that they're a victim. It only reinforces it for them. A few years ago, I had a little Sue that I was working with, and she called me one night at work, and I was busy, but I talked to her for a few minutes, and her live-in boyfriend had just left, packed and left, and she was crying, and poor me, and poor this. And in a few minutes, I said, "Sue, don't let it spoil your whole weekend." And I hung up. We're still friends. I was talking to her a few weeks ago. We were laughing about this. She said, "You made me so angry." And I knew I had. But that was okay. I was not going to agree with her that she was a victim. I would have been harmful to Sue. We're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character and humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. I think these are the two most powerful steps in the program because they transform Donna Lancaster. They change me. And it's nothing that I can do. I can only become willing. And the change is done for me. And it transforms me into another person. I've done a lot of studying on being a victim. That's the reason I can recognize it so easy. I can spot it like that because I'm very familiar with it. I've been a victim all my life. I mean, you did it to me, let's face it. It's your fault. Several years ago, I remember I thought, well, I won't put on any lipstick this afternoon. They'll know how tired and overworked I am. Anytime I start telling you what a tough time I'm having, I'm feeling like a victim. And it may be something very like the neighbor's dogs barked all night. I remember it hadn't been too many years ago. Someone said, "You really have on a pretty coat." And I said, I just got it out of layaway. See, the message was well, things are really tough for me. And who cares? Today I do not want to be a victim because today this program has taught me that I'm responsible. I've done a lot of study on anger and resentment, and I find that if I do not make a judgment, I will have neither anger nor resentment. A few years ago, I got a handle on a thought, and it said that Donna Lancaster is doing the very best that she can do at a given moment. Now, this may not be the best that I'm potentially capable of doing, but at that moment, with the willingness, with the understanding, with the experience, I was doing the very best I could do. And you know what? That relieves the guilt. And I know that's true for me. I do the very best I can do at a given moment with what light I have to see by. And if this is true for me, then it must be true for you. And how could I possibly criticize you or resent you or become angry with you when you're doing the very best you can do? I do become angry and resentful occasionally because I forget to remember that you are doing the very best you can do with what light you have to see by. It's a great thought. And I would hope that I can be a better rememberer. To remember that. Because there's something in you that is so great. There's something behind your eyes that is beyond what we can even imagine. It's beyond our finite comprehension. And how could I possibly become angry with you? I'm trying to learn to be a builder-upper instead of a tear-downer. So if I don't make a judgment, and I eat on that apple every day, the apple of what's right and wrong and good and bad, and I forget, but if I remember, I know you're doing the very best you can do, and so am I. I've done some work on projecting guilt. We're very good at it. And I would find myself cleaning out the garage at a time when the person I had asked to clean out the garage would catch me. very subtle. But see, throwing guilt around in loving someone unconditionally are diametrically, that's a big word, opposed. They are not in harmony. They're opposed to each other. So I want to lift you up rather than tear you down. So I'm watching when I say little things to make you feel guilty or make you feel bad. And sometimes they're so, you know, they're right there. So I'm trying to learn not to do that. I had a friend named Peggy who had 4 children and a drunk husband, and I would call her to go to the meeting with me, and one night she said, "Donna, I wish you'd quit trying to make me feel guilty when I don't go to a meeting with you." Well, I can't stand constructive criticism. So after I cried, I saw that she was right. And the only way that I could work with Peggy was to love her right where she was. Whether she went to as many meetings as I thought she ought to go to, or do the steps the way I thought she ought to do them, just love her right where she is. And to reinforce her okayness, whether I agreed with it or not. We are all unique. We all have our own uniqueness. And someone else's may not be mine, and mine may not be theirs. I don't know. That data is not available to me. So my only responsibility is to support you right where you are today. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Well, I made a list of all the people I didn't like and why I did, and why I didn't like them. That was the beginning. And I found out that I didn't like them because I had made a judgment on them. And I made the amends when I could, when I needed to. And so the first 3 steps get me going with God. The next 4 steps get me clean with me. And the next 2 steps, 8 and 9, get me straight with you. And now I can continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Now, I don't come around, I love to be right. And that's the ego again. But I'm learning to say, you may be right. I don't come clear out and say, you're right. I say, you may be right. I qualified. Several years ago, a person I'd worked with came over this big hill on her way to work, and one morning she ran into the office and she said, "Don, that gully must be 3,000 feet deep." Well, I knew it couldn't have been over 300, but I said, "You may be right." Now, a few years ago, we would have taken a tape measure out there. We would have measured that sucker. Who cares how big the gully is? I don't have to be right. It's fun. I love it, but I don't have to be today. I'm learning to say that I care about you. I don't know if many of you in this room were probably raised as I was, where we didn't touch each other. It seemed to be embarrassing or uncomfortable. And so I knew my mother and daddy loved me. I knew they cared about me, but they didn't touch me. And so, but I'm learning to do that. They didn't say, I love you, and you really did good in school, and I'm so proud of you. I knew they were, but they didn't say the words. And I remember the first trip that Neil and I made back to my parents after we were married, and we got in the car after we'd left that Sunday noon, and Neil said, "Donna," of course, we were in the program then, he said, "Donna, I'm not going to bring you up in here anymore to see your mother and daddy. unless you kiss them goodbye before we leave. Well, but it's hard to do, to break through that. And in the last few years before Daddy died, I was able to tell him that I loved him. And the first time was over the telephone. And there was this big, long, uncomfortable silence on the other end of the phone. But before he died, he could say, "I love you too, Donna." And my brother in New York, it's only been in the last year that he's been able to say that to me. At first he'd say, "We love you." But in the last few months, he said, "I love you too." So I'm learning to say, take the risk of saying things to other people that I really mean. I like you. I like being around you. I'm glad you're my friend. To say those things. I'm learning that I can say that I'm sorry, even when it's not my fault. If saying I'm sorry, I apologize, heals it and makes it okay, I'll say the words. Doesn't matter. I'll say the words to you. I'm sorry that we've had a misunderstanding. It's okay. You see, this program has allowed me to be responsible. This program has allowed me to be responsible for what goes on inside me. You cannot make me angry without my permission. Circumstances cannot make me feel sorry for myself and a victim without my permission. And I found something that really works. All my life, however I felt, that was how I acted. So if I woke up depressed, I acted depressed. And if I were angry, I acted angry or resentful. And I found that the key for me is to choose the way I want to feel and then take the action and the feelings will follow. So today, if I want to feel grateful, I choose the ways that I can demonstrate my gratitude. If I'm grateful for my car, maybe I'll run it by the and get it washed or clean it. If I'm grateful for where I live, maybe I'll clean out some drawers or do some things to act out my gratitude. If I'm grateful for this body that I live in, maybe I'll take better. I floss my teeth every day because I'm grateful I have teeth. I want to take care of the teeth that I have. So I floss every day. That's one way I show my gratitude. And I can act my way into right feeling. I don't think myself into right actions. I act myself. Action is the same as prayer. So when I'm taking the action, I'm praying. I am not a victim of my emotions. Thank goodness. I am responsible, and I can, today, I can feel the way I choose to feel. What a freedom. Tremendous freedom. Today, I can be happy, joyous, and free. That is my responsibility. Sometimes I don't like the responsibility, and I like to blame other people. I remember a few years ago, Neil and I had gone somewhere, and I'd taken a travel iron, and he wanted me to press his jacket before the meeting, which I did. And while the iron was so hot, I thought, well, I'll press the collar on my dress. And when I did, the whole collar burned out. But if Neil hadn't asked me to press his jacket... Today, I choose to be happy, joyous, and free. Regardless of what's going on in the people and the circumstances around me. I can do that. I have the tools to do that. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as He understood us. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. I thought I could drift in and out of Al-Anon meetings And this dove of peace would come and descend on my shoulder. And I would walk off into the sunset and everything would be wonderful. Doesn't work that way. Neil was a good AA. Some of you here have met him. He had 28 or 9 years of sobriety when he died. But the last couple years of his life, Neil was sick. And of course, we went to a lot of meetings. Neil was my best friend. And on a scale of 0 to 10, we had a 9.5 marriage. We had a lot of fun. But in the last year or two, some things were going on in his head. And of course, in Al-Anon, we let go and let God and, you know, live and let live. And Neil got real sick. And so did I. And I didn't know what was going on. But I knew in October and September and October of 1981 that I was dying. And so on October 5th of 1981, I filed for divorce. And I told Neil, I said, I love you, but I cannot live with you. And he was okay with that. So I helped him to find a place to live, and we went to meetings together, and I called him every day, and I talked to him. And we were okay with that. I probably loved him more then than I had for a while. On December 14th, our divorce was final. And on December 2nd, 2 weeks later, Neil died. And I thought I had killed him. I can tell you what intense grief and guilt are. Here was this man who was delightful to be around and was not harmful to me. I felt like I had deserted a very sick man. I then found out that he had marked atrophy of the brain. He was really sick, but I did not know that. Somewhere I read that if we are the least bit irritable, we're covering up intense rage. And I was irritable. I remember after Neil had died, it had been maybe a month or two, some friends and I had gone to a restaurant to eat. And behind us, a baby was crying. And I thought, if that kid doesn't stop crying, I'm going to get up and choke it. And I saw that I was covering up intense rage. I mean, I was so, of course, I thought this. I mean, why wouldn't God have told me Neil was going to die? I would have stayed with him. So I was angry at God for not letting me know. So I took a tennis racket and a pillow one day while I was home alone. And I beat on that pillow with the tennis racket. And I started with just the people I didn't like around me. And, you know, it kind of, things come to mind. And this took about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, and I finally got to God, and I told God how I really felt about it, and that he had done it to me. I mean, it was his fault that I was so miserable. And then I got to myself, and that's where I found all this conflict and all this stuff. So anyway, with one blow of that tennis racket, I hit the pillow, and I let go of that God that judged me when I was wrong or rewarded me when I was good. The cosmic scorekeeper was not real in my life anymore. And when I finished, I felt a sense of freedom that I never felt before. And when it tells us to let go of preconceived ideas, I let them all go. I did not believe in God. I did not believe in the program. I didn't believe in Jesus. I didn't believe in the Bible. I didn't believe in life. I thought it was one big joke. I could find no value in my life. I was empty. And I guess it took about 18 months before some information came to me. And it wasn't very much, and I still don't have very much. But maybe this ego, see this ego that controls me a lot of the time, likes to feel safe. And I felt safe when I believed things, even if they weren't true. So when I let everything go, I felt nebulous, like I wasn't grounded. Now I worked and I functioned and I did what I needed to do, but I just didn't know anymore. I didn't know. And I had to become comfortable not knowing, maybe before the knowing came. And one day I was sitting on the deck and I heard the birds sing. And I thought, what is it within myself that takes those vibrations and transforms them into sounds that are beautiful? And I could see all these millions of color pictures that these little pieces of eyes took. Millions of them every day, color photographs, perfect color photographs. And my eyes could take these vibrations and transform them into beauty. I thought, and I knew then that there was something within myself that was intangible and invisible that lived me, called life. I can't take a course in it to understand it. I couldn't read a book or go to a seminar. It was something that was experienceable. And that this life within me made my heart beat and my lungs breathe and my skin feel warm. And it lived me. And I realized at that time that God was synonymous with life. And it tells about this attorney that asked a teacher, said, "What do I have to do to inherit eternal life?" And the teacher said, Well, you're an attorney. What does the law say?" And the attorney said, "Well, it says I must love God with all my heart, with all my soul, and with all my being." And the teacher said, "That's right." So I took the word God and put the word life, and it says, I must love life with all my heart and with all my soul and with all my being. And I can do that. When I changed the word God to life, it was like it just expanded it, made it all-encompassing. I live and move and have my being in life. In the apartment where I live, I have lots of plants and their life. I have a little finch, so precious, and he's life. I am surrounded by life. Life lives me. And when I could see that, I could see that I have no concept of this magnificence that we all are. We are so much more than we can even imagine that we are. We can see and we can walk and we can talk and we can move and laugh and cry. Incredible. At the same time, I started to see that this body that is my house, my home that I'm living in, is incredible. You see, in 1952, I was a junior at the University of Kansas, and I was this height. And through a series of connections, and I won't go into them, I was put in contact with a artificial limb maker. And he said he could make me artificial limbs that would make me 5'8". Well, this was in 1952, and I was 20 years old, and I'd never had a date. And when I went to his shop, and he put me up on some just kind of experimental legs, and his wife threw a skirt around me, and they stood me up in front of a full-length mirror, and I saw this lovely co-ed. I mean, it was incredible. I thought, this is the key to romance. And it was. I took dancing lessons and I started having boyfriends and it was a whole new world. But I loved being 5'8". And I was able to wear pretty clothes and nice shoes. And I wasn't down here with all these bottoms. So for the next 32 years, I wore those artificial legs, and I was tall. Now, I functioned on them. I was a medical technologist, and I sold real estate. I did pretty well on them. But because this program works in my life, I found out that this body that I'm living in is perfect for Donna Lancaster, and that I don't have to drag those legs around anymore, and that you really don't care whether I'm short or tall. So it was about this time that I was going from being tall back to being short, and that's a whole nother story, friends. It's not as easy as I thought it would be, but it worked. And of course, I was put in contact. A friend of mine told me that there was a new company going into business in Dallas, and they were going to hire only women pilots. And since I had the credentials and I'm a pilot, I went to Dallas to apply for the job. Now, the first job interview I went, I was 5'8". The second interview, I was short, and they hired me anyway. I'll tell you a little bit about flying here. I've learned a lot from flying. I'd always wanted to fly. I took aeronautics in high school, and that was 1956. Everybody's telling their age up here, so I'll tell you, I'm 61. I know you don't believe that, but I really... But I'd always wanted to fly, but I didn't think I could because I couldn't reach the pedals. But I think it was the early 70s, 1971 or something. Neil and I had gone someplace. We'd driven all day, and we were tired, and I turned to him, and I said, I wish we could fly, and he said, why don't we? The next morning, we went down to the bank, and we borrowed money we didn't have to buy a plane we couldn't fly. And the banker didn't even ask us if we could fly the plane before he loaned us some money to buy it. So I started taking flying lessons, and I loved it. I ate it. I bored everybody with it because I ate it, I slept it, I dreamt it, I walked it. I mean, it's a tremendous experience. But I'd be coming in for a landing, and I'd think, the guys at the airport were watching me. I knew they were. So they thought, will she or won't she make it down this time? But my attention was on what they were thinking about my landing. And I could see that any time I became uncomfortable or ill at ease, it was usually because I was thinking about what someone else was thinking about me. And you know what the truth is? Everyone else is thinking about what I'm thinking about them. And I don't even give that a thought. So I had to look at that. I also learned from flying that it is the wind pushing against the wing. The resistance of the wind against the wing that gives it lift. And the greater, the more forceful this resistance is towards this wing, the more lift there is. And so I could see that, and I thought, all the resistance in my life is a gift. It's given to me as a gift, because without the resistance, I won't have any lift. I won't have any growth. I won't have any movement within myself. I have to have the resistance. And it may be the resistance of the weather. So it may have rained on my picnic. Maybe somebody threw my dolly in the dust. Or it may be the resistance in here that says, you know, what's the use? It may be the inertia that's in here, that's resistance. But this resistance is necessary in order to grow me. It may be that my world has fallen apart. But resistance is a gift, because God loves me so much that it wants me to grow. And the only way I can grow is to have some resistance. If I didn't have the resistance, I would become like jelly. so I have to have the resistance. So I'm learning to say thank you for this God-awful resistance in my life. Thank you for this pain in my life. Thank you when people don't approve of me. Thank you when it is so uncomfortable. Because that is resistance, and it's a gift to make me grow. I learned from flying that there is an invisible and intangible instrument system, and that this instrument, if I will just monitor the little gauges in my plane and just make the little corrections, just tiny corrections, that I can plug into this instrument guidance system. And that when I break out from the undercast, that runway is going to be right on my nose of my plane, and it's going to say, "Donald Lancaster, you're cleared to land." But I have to plug into this instrument guidance system. I have to be on the right channel. I have to have the right frequency plugged in there so that I will get the information that I need in order to guide this tiny little craft. And I have an airplane now, and I work for Jet East, and they let me keep my little plane. It weighs 600 pounds, and they let me keep it in the big hangar with those sexy Learjets. So anyway, I got this job, this marvelous job flying airplanes. So I lived about 80 miles south of Dallas, and so I rented the house that I was living in then and gave my little poodle away, and I quit my job and I left my friends, and I got an apartment in Dallas. And this was on Thursday. And I'd gone to the grocery store to get some milk and bread and eggs, and on the way home from the store, a boy ran a stop sign and wrecked my car. And at this time, I'm glad that I didn't know that on Monday morning when I reported to my new job that the company had dissolved and I was unemployed. A friend of mine said I'd had a universal enema. I'm going to tell you this story because I've been a goal setter all my life. And goals cause stress, friends. And I found out that I didn't know what I was going to do. I would have been at this point willing to be a chambermaid at the Holiday Inn. I didn't care. But they told me that Jet East was looking for a dispatcher. Now, I didn't know what an aircraft dispatcher was. That information was not in my computer. So I couldn't have set a goal to be an aircraft dispatcher. The information wasn't there. So I took my resume and I went to Jet East and I said, "I understand you're looking for a dispatcher. I want to apply for the job." Well, 2 days later, they hired me. And it's a pretty stressful job. I got shingles the first 2 months I was there. But you see, I love this job. I love these pilots and these airplanes, and the work I do is just, it's just wonderful. I can't wait to get to work. And I would have missed this experience if I'd been a goal setter. I have a definition of surrender it's not spooky or cosmic or anything. It's just something that works for me. And it says that I cease to think that I know what ought to be. Now, when I can do that, then incredible things happen to me because I don't have it all fixed up here, which blocks my good. Then I'm free. I'm free to experience this day, regardless of whether it goes my way or not. I can experience. What's going to happen to me today is going to happen to me anyway, so I might as well do it with good grace and be free to experience it and not be angry because it didn't go my way. It's okay if it doesn't go my way. So I love this job at Jet East, and you see, life knew what I needed. Life loves me so much that it will bring into my experience exactly what I need in order for me to actualize my potential. And I don't know what that is. But life is moving me toward that. It's incredible. But I have to trust that. I have to trust life to know that it knows what is right for me, what is best for me, what is to my advantage. So what does it boil down to today? I think it boils down to purpose. You see, I've had a purpose that didn't work. I had a purpose to be comfortable. My purpose for life was to be comfortable and to find the right person, the right relationship, the right job, the right car, the right house, the right bank account, the right this, the right that. And when those things were all fixed, then I would be happy. We had a lesson, I was chairman a few weeks ago at our Al-Anon group. I go to the Ryzen group in Dallas. And we had the lesson on, I will be happy when. So those things don't work. I had a purpose of being approved of. And there are probably 50% of people who don't approve of me from the day I was born. So that ain't going to work. An insatiable need for approval, it won't work if that's my purpose. A need to be comfortable all the time, that won't work, because as long as I'm living in this body, I'm going to be uncomfortable at times. There will be times when I hurt. There will be times when I'm in physical pain. There will be times when other people will ignore me or reject me. There will be times when I will be criticized. That's part of the package, friends. So if my purpose is to avoid all those things, I'm in deep doo-doo. So when I was able to see that, I could change my purpose. And when the purpose changes, then the whole life is transformed. So now I have a different purpose. My purpose today is to be a good guest on the planet. I ask myself four questions. What am I? Where am I? What's going on? And what can I do? The answer to the first question, what am I? I'm a privileged, invited guest. The second, where am I? I'm on this beautiful estate called Earth. What's going on? Where there are a lot of people together playing games, it's called a party. So I'm a privileged, invited guest at this incredible party on this beautiful estate called Earth. And the party's put on by the host, Life. I came to this planet as a guest 61 years ago, and I had two slaves to take care of me. I couldn't even speak the language. I came in with nothing. And yet everything that I have needed has been abundantly supplied. The host has given me an incredible party. And so there might be some things that I would want to do, not because I had to, or not because I was expected to, or that I must, but because I wanted to, because I'm so glad I was invited to the party. There might be some things I would want to do that would make a contribution. And so my contribution today is try to be harmless by not agreeing with you that you're a victim. My contribution today is to contribute a good attitude, and that's my responsibility. And probably that's the greatest gift that I can give planet Earth, is to walk around with a happy heart. What greater gift can I give than that? And that's because I want to, because I'm so glad I'm here. I'm so glad that I was chosen to have a gift called life. And so my purpose today is to be a good guest, and that covers all the bases. That covers driving in traffic. That covers everything at work. That covers going to an Al-Anon meeting and being in a meeting and dealing with other people. Now, I'm not always a good guest, but that's my aim. That's my purpose today. And to express joy. Somewhere it says that man is that he may have joy. So if I don't have joy today, I am not within life's aim for me. What a gift. I have lived in two incredible worlds, a short world and a tall world. And of all the people in the whole world, I am the most richly blessed. May the road rise to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the rains fall gently on your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the hollow of his hand. God bless you, and I love you. Thank you.